Hello everyone, and welcome to the Pep Talks podcast, hosted by Pep Talks MD Sam Smith and me, Pep Talks Head of Marketing Richard Ayliffe. This week we are joined by experienced healthcare CEO Craig Smith. Craig joined healthcare and specialist transport providers Ezek Medical as CEO in 2021, following an MBO by Cairngorm Capital. In 2023, he oversaw a significant merger with ERS Medical, resulting in a rebrand to eMed Group, where Craig remains as CEO. eMed Group worked to proactively improve the well-being of communities by delivering health and care services with logistical complexities. How Craig organised and executed this significant merger is one of our key topics of discussion for this episode. We also dive into how he drove significant growth as CEO of both Ezek and eMed through a heavy focus on culture, restructuring programmes, product diversity and innovation, and building a winning senior leadership team. I hope you enjoy. Hello everyone, welcome to this episode of the Pep Talks podcast. I'm here as usual with Pep Talks MD Sam Smith.
Hey Richard.
And also with our guest today, Craig Smith, CEO of eMed Group. Hi Craig.
Hi, great to meet you guys.
And thank you for coming to our offices. I think this might be the first time we've actually recorded in our offices, Sam.
Yeah, this is really nice and comfortable.
Pep Talk Towers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In a quiet room, yeah.
So I just wanted to jump in initially, I guess, start at the beginning of your journey as a PE-backed CEO, which was with Ezek in 2021.
Right, yep.
And that was your first PE-backed CEO role. You'd gone from COO, hadn't you?
That's correct, yes.
And I know we've got a lot of listeners who are execs. They've probably got aspirations to step up into that role. So it'd be good to get to know why you think it is you landed that role. What were your experiences and what sort of skill set do you think you had?
Yeah, thanks. So I think as reflecting on this, and I think I came into the process with, I think, three key traits. So I'd been in the market for about 5 years or so previously. So I had a pretty solid understanding of the market and some of the sort of underlying principles and characteristics of the market. And then I think what was important, I was able to add clarity of thought and an analytical approach, which transpires working with the PE houses is one of their kind of key things, being driven by numbers ultimately. And I was able to sort of put together a story about how I could see the business growing over what was the timescales that they were aligned to. And I was sort of able to coherently draw that together with understanding some of the market drivers. And probably I think those three elements allowed me being in the right place at the right time as well a little bit, but being able to kind of tell that story through detailed analytical understanding to then say this is how I see the business taking shape over the next 3 to 5 years, and ultimately allowing them to sit on their side of the table and tick to say yeah, this meets the kind of investment thesis we had for this business. And the longer you work with the PE houses, the more you realize that whilst they have the big picture, the detail of how they're going to get from A to B in a really quite aggressive timeline, they need the management team to kind of drive that story forward.
Yeah.
And what was the brief really that you were sort of looking at that stage, and in giving us understanding of the brief, also give us a sort of sense of what the business was when Cairngorm invested.
Yes, so Cairngorm invested, so it was a primary buyout of Ezek, so it was a family-run business that had grown up over, I think, probably about 10 years up to that point. Had been really quite successful in winning core contracts in our market, so predominantly outsourcing of NHS services, so they were able to kind of win those contracts and build those up. And the opportunity at that stage was really to say, how do we take this sort of embryonic business and really start to drive it and really start to take advantage of what we felt some favourable market conditions, and so take the business at pace. Maybe it had taken them 10 years to get from A to B. The exam question was, how do you get from B to C in a third of the time? For a whole load more pressure on it with a much more a debt structure and kind of almost a grown-up business. And so the brief at the time was to kind of get into the business. They'd been 6 months through the whole cycle, so already kind of maybe a third of the way through the time, just about, and the brief was really to kind of go in and sort of take what I described through the interview process and that strategy and really start to embed that through the business. And I think that one of the first kind of challenges I found really was around communication, and then some more communication, and then more communication, and getting the context right, and understanding the business you joined had been in this owner-led environment, quite comfortable, kind of moving at a pace everybody sort of knew, and suddenly the rules had changed. Mm-hmm. And now there's this new investor, and nobody quite understood what it meant, or who was making what decisions, or what the plan was. And just being that interface to be able to articulate the vision, the strategy, and really making sure the business had a clear purpose. I think when I joined it, its purpose was one-dimensional, sort of win and deliver contracts, rather than thinking the broader sense and making sure I was the middle between the shareholders and supporting their requirements and the business that needed a lot of support and time to really kind of start to get up that kind of change curve.
Sure. I guess there's just like a huge amount of transparency through that whole process to make sure you're aligned when you eventually come in. Is there like an element of, you know, you're talking about the strategy going forward. Obviously, you had a lot of industry knowledge. During the interview process, they're talking to you about this potential strategy. Is there any element of you actually going, I'm not actually sure that's quite right, I think you should do this?
There was a big piece of that, actually. Yeah. Big piece. And I think, again, the sort of investment thesis on the way in talked a lot about sensible, you know, and underpinning thematics they were looking at. But actually, you came into the business and you realise this is a people business. It's people first. You need a really strong people agenda. We don't own any IP. We don't really own, you know, our systems, or, you know, our vehicles at least, the building, you know, buildings at least. So our kind of currency, if you like, was our people. And so one of the first things we did with the Priority guys was say, look, we've got to change what we're looking at here. Mm. And I've got to get the best people agenda I can. And that needs bringing in a CPO and a learning and development team and really and a recruitment team and making sure we're really clear on our people strategy. And I think that was quite a deviation from the original kind of the original plan, much more around systems and automation. I was like, we can't go there until we've got the people agenda right. And so our focus from day one is still on our people.
Sure.
If we can get that right, that unlocks, you know, we'll come on and talk about growth and the plan, but having absolute kind of clarity on how do you want to sort of support your people was just the number one priority. And so we went on a journey in the boardroom about what that meant. Mm-hmm. Not the cheapest thing to bring in teams, you know, kind of the counter opposite to a cost out, you know, EBITDA expansion plan where you can sort of use systems and automation to take cost out of the center. And we did the opposite, and we continue to do the opposite because we were able to drive alignment through the boardroom all the way down through the business about what's important and what's going to be the underpinning piece of this business going forwards.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, let's definitely talk a bit more about that. But before doing so, should we just give us that vision and purpose that you're now driving towards?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So when I look at back at the business grew up delivering what we would describe as non-emergency patient transport services. So in one sense, it was what we do is we support people to get from home to hospital and back again. And actually, when we started to think about it and lift our horizons, a list of vision, there was a two or three buzzwords. Every time I spoke to anybody in the business, there was sort of community came through loud and clear. Access to healthcare. And so we started to say, actually, what is the purpose of this business? What do we do? Why does everyone get out of bed every day? And it's all down to the value we add to the communities by getting them access to healthcare. Uh-huh. And it's such a powerful kind of purpose. And so we started to explore and understand that from our core customer being the NHS. And the fact you could have the best hospital system in the world, but if patients can't get there in time for their appointment in a safe way and then can't get home again afterwards, and if we can't get people out the back door of the hospital once they've had their sort of, you know, been in for treatment, then the system stops to work, and it stops to work in about 24 hours, I think. So we're a key enabler to healthcare throughout the UK. We're not doing surgery, we're not doing open heart surgery, but what we are doing is a complex service of managing supply and demand, picking people up for their houses often who've not been out of the house sometimes for days or weeks because of their mobility. You were crossing the threshold into the house, supporting the patient, into the ambulance, to the hospital, and back again. And we're doing that about 1.5 million times a year at the moment. And what we then started to do with the purpose is just starting to expand that a little bit. So actually, if our reason for existence is to support access to healthcare, well, what other cohorts of people need the same kind of support? And so we started to look at children with special education needs, challenges who should be going to school and can't go to school because their electric wheelchairs don't fit in a school bus. Mm-hmm. We're driving past a house every day with a purpose-built vehicle with staff on board that are caring, empathetic, and want to support the communities. And so we started to say, well, why can't we go and support this kind of cohort of people? What about people with mental health challenges? Huge pressures in the system at the moment. How can we help that system? How can we get people with really severe mental health issues to access to the healthcare that they deserve and entitled to? And that again opened up a whole sort of segue into a nice adjacent market for us to go and look at. And then the final part of the question was really, well, what about when we take the healthcare to the patient? What about lots of buzzwords flying around at the moment in the budget last week around automation, AI, virtual wards? All of this is premised on you getting equipment to the patient in their house, mm-hmm. and supporting the patient in their house. And we start to say, well, we can be a key enabler of that. So yeah, I think part of this journey was us, me setting with the board and then through the business a really clear strategy that went beyond the 2 to 3 year vision, but actually laid our cards out on the table to, this is what we think this business can do, this is the purpose of the business. Mm. And getting that articulated all the way through about access to health and social care and how we can play a critical part to supporting our communities. And repetition of that message, internal and external, at different levels in the business and what that means was a really key part of the first couple of years of the journey, and probably the key thing that I do as CEO. Say that message in different ways all the time, but making sure people really understand what that means and, mm-hmm. and empowering the business to go and find ways to do that.
Have you measured the impact of that sort of repositioning of purpose and strategy on your people? So, you know, like employee questionnaires,
yeah,
and surveys,
yes,
and
yes,
and NPS so, engagement.
And I'm actually in the middle of a series of roadshows that go out kind of once a year and sort of talk about the strategy. And what struck me over the last couple of sessions, we pushed our teams really quite hard this year through kind of all sorts of initiatives, trying to sort of, you know, professionalize the business, trying to driving growth. But the positivity in the room about the alignment to the vision is really quite palpable. It feels strong. It's the reason that sort of glues everybody together. And I think I go back a couple of years ago when you spoke to people about what's the vision, what's the purpose of this business? And it was sort of, well, to do some, you know, do some transactional stuff with the NHS. There was no larger purpose. It was there, it's always been there, but drawing that out and getting people to really think about it has been a really key part, I think, of the sort of the people agenda. And we look at, you know, churn rates and all the other standard KPIs you would expect, and they're all moving in the right direction. And I think a lot of that's been down to, you know, really making the purpose of the business shine through in everything we do.
Mm. Well, if people can be energized and excited about why they do what they do and why they turn up for work, I mean, it just makes a massive difference. And you did that, but clearly you also looked at expanding your addressable or accessible market. So,
yeah.
You know, you were just doing sort of one or two things when the business was bought. And now you're providing a whole suite of services to a patient, whether that's taking them to and from the healthcare or actually delivering healthcare to them. I saw before, I was just looking at your website before we came down and had this chat, and I could see that aren't you trying something with drone services?
Just drone technology, yeah, absolutely, in our kind of courier division. So we have it's about 10% of revenues at the moment is on courier services. This is really around pathology and sort of supporting GP surgeries and clinics to get bloods into sort of the path labs. And it's really interesting because it's it's probably the most logistic element of our business. It is a set runs. You go pick up, you drop off the kit, pick up the bloods, drop them off. And we're really being quite successful, again, growing that area. And we're competing, you might say, against more traditional logistic companies that are probably far more logistically efficient than us. But the key part there is the healthcare lens that's winning that work, is the fact that, you know, through to every single of our courier drivers, they understand that that is a, you know, that's a blood sample of someone who may or may not have cancer. So I better treat it with the respect it deserves and get it to the technician in the right state, and it's been temperature controlled, and not just chuck it in the back of the van along with all the other parcels. And that kind of, it's just the criticality of thinking about how important that is for that individual who's waiting for those samples is the inherent reason, I think, that we are successful there. And so, yes, we're looking at drone technology in Norfolk. Can we, you know, fly the drones to the GP surgeries? Does it stop, you know, driving there? Is it more efficient, more effective? Probably a little bit early in the...
A few hoops to jump through there, isn't
there? A few hoops to jump through, yeah. But it displays a little bit of the innovation and the thought process.
But why not? I mean, look what's happening. Mm. I know it's a completely different subject area, but look how drones are affecting the war in Ukraine. I mean, you know, why look at the impact they're having on the battlefield. Why couldn't you have just a positive impact on healthcare? I mean, and that battlefield has forced the adoption of new technologies. You know, why should we be slow in adopting technologies as a force of good?
Amazon are doing it in some areas already, aren't they?
Yeah, and if you ask the question, who's going to be more likely to get the sign off from the...
Yeah.
Is it going to be Amazon to move your parcels, or is it going to be us moving healthcare and phlebotomy? So, you know, it's only going to be one winner in terms of who's going to get the signature, you would assume, first. So, yeah, it's just, it's an interesting one. I think it will take a little bit of time to develop. And we'll see how that kind of matures over the next kind of 10 to 20 years. But, you know, innovation is the lifeblood of the business. If you don't look at this and explore this, someone else is, absolutely.
So you've repurposed the business. You've got a clear sense of strategic plan and value creation plan. You're developing new products and services, so opening up your addressable market. But we know you've also done some pretty heavy acquisitions as well, haven't you? And you are no longer called EZEC, called EMED.
Yes. Yes. So we were fortunate enough to be able to do what I'd describe as a transformative acquisition, or really a merger. So you can argue about the technicalities of, you know, the shares transitioning, but with a company called ERS Transition at the time, who were the second or the first largest provider and player in the market, depending on what you looked at. And that was a huge kind of strategic opportunity for us to kind of really get market share as an organisation. And so there was a lot of work done beforehand about making sure that what we weren't just doing is buying contracts and EBITDA, because we felt that we could do that organically. But actually, it was about the value you got through the two organisations and putting them together. And we sort of talked a lot pre-deal and post-deal about two heads are better than one being the mentality. You've got this great business that's growing up alongside, and, you know, you're the enemy yesterday, and then today you're friends. Which I'll come on to some of the challenges there. But again, about the pragmatic approach of, well, how can we learn from each other? And what is this platform for? And I think one of the key reflection points for me when we're looking at the end of the last year and asking, okay, was it a successful integration of the two businesses? We went back to, well, what was the business case? What was the plan? Why were we doing this? And why did we want this to happen in February? And it's about a platform for further accelerated growth, basically, because we would have, you know, a dominant position in the UK from Cornwall all the way up through into Durham. So, but again, we sort of look back and look at the organic growth, and we're winning more than we're losing previously. So that kind of played into us sort of becoming a stronger brand, a stronger business. If I look at the C-suite roles, you know, the executive team is about 50-50 blend. So we're taking the, you know, some people naturally sort of drop off on these things for all sorts of reasons, but we've kept a good mix. Mm-hmm. I think we've truly looked at both of the businesses and looked at what was good and what was improvement and try to roll through the good. And so that learning culture from day one, I think, has been really quite prevalent. And I sit here now thinking, yeah, we're no longer ESEC or ERS, we're EMED. So depending who I talk to, depends if it's short for ESEC Medical or ERS Medical. Mm-hmm. But I think in the spirit of actually, it's a sum of the two. Systems, processes, procedures, organisational design is all being aligned now, and a huge amount of effort last year. I think the easy answer, particularly when you start to have some trading pressures, as you always do inevitably, I think, in these things, is to keep them separate, don't integrate, and just do it slowly over time. Whereas we push really hard into an integration so that we could have this kind of platform for growth.
Yeah.
And I think it's sometimes hard, it's not tangible to measure it in kind of immediately in sort of synergies and sort of trading performance, but actually inherently, are you one business and do you feel and act, and can you measure and look at KPI suite that's automatically generated by the same system across all 52 operational sites now? Mm-hmm. We can tick those boxes. So we do feel, I certainly feel we're now a truly integrated business that's now EMED.
Sure.
And now it's all about the future, and that's a really exciting thing for us.
Yeah. How did that work with the whole sort of cultural piece and the purpose piece, like it sort of integrating those together? Obviously they're quite similar businesses, so I guess there was an element of that already, but how did you sort of align both businesses under one purpose?
So I think about the position of it was really important. It was a merger. Mm-hmm. Really, you know, important to the BB. If you've been part of these businesses building it up over years and suddenly it's moving again. And there's a lot about sort of the time on the road and, you know, sitting with people, talking to people.
Sure.
The first few weeks post the announcement, again, shock of capture, to describe it. You know, people turn up to work on 1st of February and guess what, you know, it's all changed. it's a difficult message, right? Yeah. And then sometimes people then certainly feel nervous and uncertain about roles and communication is just, which we felt was so important about making sure people knew what the story was, the clarity of messaging through businesses always down to the frontline staff was important for us. And then understanding, explaining, not really say this is the investment thesis, but you changing the terminology to say this is why we're doing this, because we want to use this as a platform to grow. We want to do more, and just making sure that we're dispelling the myths of a standard PE, M&A, strip out overhead. Actually, we've reinforced, built up the overhead because it's a kind of a growth play.
Yeah. And I guess there's a benefit in the 50-50 senior leadership team split as well, because they're able to buy in and sort of communicate that to the people they know.
Yeah, and I think it's a kind of perfect outcome, if you like, in terms of balance. We didn't go into it necessarily saying that's one of the rules, but it was about, you know, ultimately looking at the skill sets of the people and understanding, you know, how do we build the best possible team for the future of the organisation. And if you look at it that way, there's some really skilled people sitting both sides, and it was a real privilege to sit and just actually had to put it all together. And from day one, we created a really positive lean-in culture of, okay, let's just take the best bits and accept that, you know, businesses were good, or, you know, different levels of the sort of that kind of, you know, path to excellence. And so why not just use it as the opportunity to take the best bits of two and put them together? And that was sort of the mantra and for day one, and then really, you know, pushing for standardization of systems. A huge amount of work to change all of our operating systems, all the back office systems. And now Alliance, we're using the same. And that, I think, the key learning, we had a debate, do we do the system or do we do the processes? Mm-hmm. The systems force the processes, and my sort of one of my learnings. So we never would have got there if you said, let's get the processes all aligned and then do the system. It's do the system, and then everybody will learn how to work around it. And that's just paid dividends in terms of the sort of command and control we now have over the business, and the clarity of KPIs that we just never would have been able to see, scrabbling together for a board meeting, not really understanding the underlying trends and our ability to pivot that data, the contract, division, group level of things has just been really powerful and a real value enabler now going forwards.
I guess the brand change was an important part of integration as well, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't you guys turning up and saying, here's our name above the door.
Yeah, 100%. And having that discussion, so we when we did the branding, we actually spent quite a lot of time talking to colleagues throughout the business, you know, what do you want? And it was quite pragmatic, actually. I remember speaking to some ambulance care assistants who were, well, it'll be weird if everybody is our brand, but we wouldn't want to be the other brand, so can we have something in the middle? And so, again, really important to get buy-in to it. I think it just sort of makes people feel part of the journey.
Mm. Was there any other low-hanging fruit? That's what others sort of talk about when it comes to sort of integration of, you know, not turning up with men in suits and telling everybody how it's going to be. Which obviously you didn't do those kinds of things. New brand on the over the door. Or keeping an existing brand. I mean, they're the two sort of obvious ones. With a system implementation to drive process improvement. With anything else in terms of culture and people that maybe they did that you didn't?
We were, I think, fortunate with the culture of... this is contracting business, so people were used to change happening. So it wasn't quite as stark as I can imagine a manufacturing business that's been owner-led for 30 years. You've only ever worked for Craig, and suddenly Craig's not there, and there's a load of suits there day one. So we were, I think, supported that by that. But I think the cultural piece of being very open from day one about it being a merger, and that we were again genuinely going to look at the best ways of doing things and pragmatically understand and then kind of reverse engineer where it made sense to do. And then just making sure we had bi-weekly management calls all the way through the year where we were just able to talk and update to people and what was going on and the decisions made and why we'd made them. And just a level of transparency, I think, gave people confidence. And then ultimately, it's just the old adage of leadership and integrity and people wanting to trust you and being able to trust the organisation. And so just being really careful on the first couple of weeks, if you say something and you don't have all the facts, be very careful, because if the situation changes, you have to then reverse back on what you said, then you start to become a little bit jeopardised as a management team. So you are going into this with a degree of uncertainty. Mm. You can do all the due diligence you want. You're going into something that you perhaps may look different on paper. So I think we were very careful, very conscious of not straying into commitments or promises up front before we were comfortable that we could commit to those, because if you lose the trust in these type of, in any business, in any organisation, then you struggle.
Yeah, I suppose you've got to do what you say you're going to do.
Yeah.
Don't backtrack.
It's very simple. Or if you say you don't know, you know, just be honest and open.
Yeah.
To the degree.
We'll come back to you.
Yeah, and there's a lot of nervousness, and you can understand it, because people jump to conclusions and start to sort of get concerned about their futures and what's going to happen, and big structural changes, and this is going to be kind of... Mm-hmm. And so they're looking to you as the leadership team for the immediate trust and sort of confidence and comfort that they've still got a job, that the business isn't going to fundamentally change the underpinning principles, and actually then start to get on board with the vision for the group. And I think that's what we navigated fairly well. Mm.
Did you look at a lot of M&A options to find this merger opportunity?
Yeah, so we had a look at that, and some in the non-core, and again, I think the kind of cultural underpinning of it was the bit that was always on my mind more so. I think you can trust your private equity partners to be all over the numbers in terms of sort of the sensitivity cases and trying to make sure that the tax has been managed appropriately and everything else. And whilst you have to be very close to that, I think the intangible piece is, can you work with the management team? Do you believe in what they've done? Do they believe in it? And are they kind of confident in what you're going to find as a business that's robust enough to kind of then be able to integrate rather than firefight and start to see that everything crumbling? And so for that was, for me, there's a couple we looked at, we just didn't feel it was right. Just didn't quite, couldn't put finger on it, but it just didn't feel felt that there would be some challenges in the first few months that would distract from being able to drive the integration piece. And so the cultural alignment was really important.
How much exposure was there between the two management teams pre-acquisition? Obviously, I imagine you were getting to know them quite well, but then there were other members of your team involved.
We ended up through the kind of C-suite roles, mm-hmm. sort of meeting.
Yeah.
To have some upfront conversation. So the people's motivations in these things can be quite different. So some people decided that this, it was going to be the off ramp, so to speak. And so having those conversations up front was again really important. So you can communicate those quite quickly, mm-hmm. Such that then you get to a point of clarity.
Yeah.
And that again, I think it was a big piece there the first couple of weeks, just to really settle down leadership teams to understand who is running the function. How does this look from an executive level? And that was quite a clear piece. So it's always a balance between sort of reading in the C-suite and mm-hmm. other roles into it before it happens, and a risk of distraction, really. But
sure.
I think key stakeholders all need to understand and be fully on board.
Yeah.
You talked earlier about the investment in people and having a CPO investing in learning and development and recruitment. Did you have that team in place pre this merger, or has that team come together post-merger?
I think we had the core components of it in pre-merger, and then we've been continuing to develop it post-merger. Mm-hmm. And again, the luxury or the beauty of our, go back to the thesis or the plan, for it was about a platform to grow. And so we've been continuing to see the business grow through our core market, which we're continuing to be quite successful in, and then the other adjacent markets we're starting to really kind of unlock and open up. So actually we've been in a journey of continuing to reinforce and grow all the teams actually over the last year, ready for future growth. And so the people agenda has been evolving and maturing. We got a few bits of it wrong, I think, initially, of what we thought was important to people transpired to be not quite so important.
Like what?
So we did a lot of apprenticeship schemes, actually, for kind of colleagues we're really appreciative of. And actually, most of our workforce are a little bit older, second careers, or just want to do the job and aren't particularly interested in apprenticeship schemes, as way of example. What they do want to know is sort of they want to be communicated with effectively, and they want their the pay to be correct and any errors adjusted in less than a day, which of course is completely reasonable, right? and so we do some work on, so we're doing a lot of work on that at the moment, a new kind of rostering solution just going in that's going to really help transparency, really focused on communication, engagement, and just continue to sort of pivot the strategy to make sure it's really supporting what our people want.
How did the CPO, the Chief People Officer, is we believe at Pep Talks, like especially in a heavily labour-intensive environment, a crucial executive hire. But actually, I mean, across our membership, I would say it's not a common role, because I suppose from an HR perspective, there's always been an HR. I bet there's always an HR element in ESEC, but that shift from HR risk and contractual management and workforce staffing management to a true people strategy, that's a very big shift, isn't it?
Yeah.
How did you go about finding that person, without necessarily going into detail, but how do you go about finding that person, and was it a difficult brief and was it a difficult job to hire for that reason?
Yeah, so I think you're right. It was an interesting journey with the shareholders getting on board that the people strategy had to be the number one strategy and the main effort, if you like, of the organisation. I think that's slightly counterintuitive to a lot of priority sort of thesis, which is around optimisation and kind of EBITDA enhancement and sort of systems and AI.
Yeah.
And that's probably on paper the more comfortable journey on a more mature business. I think for us it was the people agenda has to come front and centre. You know, without our people there is nothing. And so I think the first step of that was to kind of have those conversations at board level to say, look, we need to invest in not just this role, but the team that's going to come with the role. And that's going to be a recurring, fairly expensive addition to central overheads. But if you don't do this, we're not going to be able to do anything with our cost of goods. And that's going to continue to be strained. And so I think the first part was having that alignment at board level that it was sensible to really invest in. And then the second piece then was to find the individual and be clear on what the role was, which, as you say, wasn't a HR director. It's a strategy that needed to be set and driven through. And so, getting clarity on what we wanted that strategy to at least broad handful look like, and then go through and find the strongest candidate you can.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I'm not saying this understanding your role in great depth, but generally across our community, you see those businesses that have hired a CPO and it's worked, is that that individual is totally aligned with you as the CEO around the value creation plan, and what they're bringing to that is how are you going to execute around people? What's your people plan to execute that value creation plan?
Yeah, and it's been interesting with us in terms of people understanding that people strategy and what it means. So we've brought in, I think, a really strong recruitment team. Now, they're talent acquisition, not recruitment. So they're bringing in people to the top of the funnel, and then the operations teams now are trying to select from the funnel. In the old world, recruitment would be, I need 10 people, go and get me 10 people and start the job next week. And so we're saying, well, actually, there's maturity of understanding in terms of, well, how do you find the best people? Well, what do they look like? What's the competency framework that's around recruitment? How do you, and we're taking the people agenda in a completely different, on a change curve that's really steep. One of the things we've had to work on is just communicating to everybody what it means. What does learning and development mean versus kind of operational training? Different things. How do you kind of make sure you've got best in class talent coming in into your machine, and then who actually go through the interview process, and then who onboards them, and how does that all tie together? How do you manage ER cases, and who's responsible for what, and what does a HR business partner do? And all of these are kind of questions that people thought they knew the answer for in one world, and then we're trying to take people to what does best in class look like, and this is how the different parts of the structure are set up. And it's not, whilst we're talking about the people, I found that a lot across the business actually, in terms of as you're taking a business on a professionalisation curve, the understanding of who does what and how things work can be lost in translation if you don't explain what the different functional areas are, and what are they doing and why are they there, because you're moving away from a kind of jack of all trades into specialists to drive certain parts of the value creation plan.
Do you think by investing in the people resources and the people strategy, you've actually saved money? I mean, from a recruitment perspective, for example, I bet a lot of that was outsourced recruitment, and now maybe there's a lot more in-house.
If you looked at a pure ROI, that's just, absolutely. Money through reducing churn, and actually having a more motivated, engaged workforce. It just pays for itself. And again, it's what's important to the business. We are a people business, so to not have a CPO and a really clear business, people strategy is crazy. I suspect if you're a software company, it's maybe not quite on the priority, but actually people are going to be driving every business.
Well, there's a massive war for talent and software, so if you're going to hire extensively, you need to have that people strategy in any type of business, I think, really. Fast growth private equity backed businesses. What are the other roles that have been fundamental to sort of, I guess, rebuilding or reshaping the management team?
So the other, I think, kind of really important piece for us was in terms of the commercial space and what was the growth plans, and how do we start to kind of build those out. And certainly looking at these, how do we win business in our core, and understanding and being clear on what allowed us to win business, and trying to find the best business development team we could and how to kind of support that. And then if we want to go and look at these new areas and these new growth areas, and we decided that M&A wasn't a viable option or we couldn't find anything suitable, you then say, okay, well, how do we sort of grow organically and bring in the required leadership into these areas? And that's been kind of an interesting kind of sort of learning curve for us. There's perhaps a degree of, I call it naivety, that you could, something that looked similar and felt similar, and you could just walk into that and you could deliver it. And we realized actually you need some slightly different, you need a slightly set of different skills. So we brought in, just recently recruited two really strong managing directors, deep sector knowledge in mental health and local authority space to look at our two new divisions. And again, that's given that some real depth there. We sort of sent our most entrepreneurial people to try and find their way through it. They did a fantastic job, but they're entrepreneurial people, so it's all a bit, so needed a bit more structure to it in terms of, again, the pace of growth is the key delineator there. That, okay, it's great to go and dip your toe in the water, we want more of this quicker, and you spin up kind of a go-to-market strategies, operational execution plans. So kind of building out the commercial team and building out the kind of, the leadership teams of the new divisions has been the other kind of, I think, key parts to us.
Yeah, so their tasks were going out and winning those contracts.
Yep.
In their service sort of lines. But are you pitching to the same person but across different service lines?
No, they're different. They're different buyers.
Different
buyers, yeah. Yeah, might have the same NHS or local authority brand, but they're very much different buyers in different parts.
Yeah.
And it's a slightly different value proposition, but at the heart of it, it's that access to healthcare. It's just basically very severe mental health issues. There's a slightly different set of clinical and operational challenges around that space.
Yeah. When you're hiring execs, are there any tips that you would pass on to others who might be listening to this? We've just done quite a big piece on executive recruitment. And for my sins, that's what I used to do before Pep Talk, so I know a bit about it. But I mean, you've been doing this for a few years now. You've done quite a lot of team reshaping. I'm just trying to sort of perfect it and get it right.
So I think the key challenge I've seen so these are growing. Wherever the business is, will grow. And that's the whole. If it doesn't grow, then we're all in trouble, right? And that's what the shareholders want, and that's what we need to deliver. So with growth becomes a tempo and a pace of life that's quite challenging. And I wonder, some people get to a level where they want to be an executive or C-suite, which means hands off, at the end of career, on about advice and guidance and just nudging the ship in a certain direction.
Yeah. Do I actually have to make some of the big decisions?
Yeah, exactly. By the way, you have to do it with half the team you might want, and I need a decision, and we need it to be, the analytics kind of robust enough for, kind of hyper-analytical people will kick it around and come back. And so there's a tempo and a pace of life, I think, in these type of businesses that you just need to have that characteristic that you're willing to roll the sleeves up and get into it. And I think if you can find that with the kind of the expertise of 20 plus years experience, then you're into a really good thing.
I agree. I think it's about you need somebody who knows what good looks like and can shift your business to a larger scale, but at the same time they're really comfortable still getting back into the weeds themselves. They're not going to say, Craig, I could do with a resourcing 10 to 15 new hires to come and help me do this. No. It's you and one other. That's it.
Yeah. I guess you're just being really transparent about those challenges in the process for hiring. Because otherwise, you're just hiring the wrong person for the wrong job, aren't you? You need to be open.
And
it's going to be challenging, but obviously really rewarding as well.
It's fun, right? I think this is the closest you can have to fun in business, where you just get, this is about growth. This is about driving and creating something.
Yeah.
And having the support from the boardroom to do that. If I look at that, go back to when Justine, the CPO, when she joined, it was a business that was on fire, it was kind of going backwards. We're now kind of 10 times EBITDA that we're run rating at, double the number of people in the business and bolting on contracts and divisionalizing and doing everything else. And it's just the growth story is going to carry on. And that's a, it's a fun journey to be on, but it's a journey that, you know, certain, it will appeal to certain people, and it's hard to get that through an interview process. You just need that kind of the energy and enthusiasm and the willingness to, as you roll your sleeves up and get into the detail. But then you can shape it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the risk, in that you take somebody from a larger corporate environment and they don't manage that transition. But often that's because we see that's because they don't necessarily understand what it truly means to be private equity backed and looking to scale quickly. And we're a bit biased in this, aren't we, Richard? But we think you can teach that. If they have the right mentality and attitude of, yeah, I'll get stuck in, I can be strategic and I'll be operational, you can actually teach them the rest of the stuff they need to know about the private equity playing field quite quickly.
Yes, I'd agree. And I think that to your point, it's being able to be strategic when you need to be strategic, and then being operational when you need to be operational. Yeah. And being able to pivot between the two is a real skill.
Yeah. Okay, great. And so the future now for you is, it sounds like the business is just set for, you know, more and better. You're not coming to the sort of the end of this. It feels like you've just set yourself up with a platform now that you can really
expand. I believe upon. So I think we've got a fantastic platform, a really, really great team in place now. Worked incredibly hard last year to integrate, to merge the two businesses, and then to pivot to the divisional structure. We think we've got a really powerful vision for this business, that enabling access to health and social care for our communities. We think we know the areas that we can add real value to that, and so it's now a story of kind of growth and just holding on, I hope, through continue to win contracts in our core, and then expanding and developing and understanding what we can do in these adjacent markets. And, you know, we've taken our TAM from probably 600 to 2.5 billion. So we've got plenty of runway. There's a great organic story going on here. We don't, hopefully don't need the complexity of M&A in the short term. We can just start to continue to sort of get this sort of business model that we've got into place and deliver on that for the next 3 to 5 years.
And having made the transition from non-PE into PE as a CEO, what do you enjoy about it? Would you go back to the corporate world, I suppose, is my question.
Yeah. So I think what I'd say about this is, and I sort of encourage everyone to think, it's a real privilege to be given the keys to the car. Real privilege when you think about the context of what you've been asked to do. It's not your capital at risk. It's not your career at risk. It's everyone around the boardroom has more to lose or win from these than CEO. So I think for me it's the privilege to continue to kind of lead the business. I think we've got a good plan in place. So for me now, I'll keep driving this business forward with the team and worry about what happens thereafter.
Yeah.
But I couldn't see going back to a more sort of corporate environment. I think the excitement you'd struggle with the excitement.
Yeah, once you make the adjustment to this type of ownership, I don't think there's anywhere better to be. I mean, we sort of call it, one of our little catchphrases is, it's like the business Olympics.
Yeah.
Because you've got to do a lot quickly, and you can't really come fifth, sixth or seventh. You need to get a medal really in the management team, and you've got to do stuff that's difficult and challenging. But once you've worked that out as to how to adjust to this new challenging playing field, it's just about the best place to be, because you are liberated to go and do it, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're aligned in value creation. You're aligned in sense of purpose. And if the business has got great value creation opportunities because of things like TAM, and it's got a great sense of purpose, it's just like, wow, what can be achieved?
Yeah. Agreed, and I think that alignment, it's a real privilege to be kind of at the helm, and we continue to kind of push the business forward the best we can.
We have to come back and talk to us in a couple more years.
Yeah.
Thanks, Craig.
Slightly more grey hair. And
thank you.
Cheers.
Appreciate it.